The Exchange's daily podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This winter, Granite Staters in nine different communities brave the snow and cold and gathered together to discuss the problem of substance abuse. Conversations were held from rural Berlin to urban Manchester to cities like Lebanon and Portsmouth, often praised for their enviable quality of life. But no matter where people met, the fears and frustrations they expressed were the same. A feeling that drug and alcohol abuse is a huge, growing problem, and that as a state, we're doing a pretty poor job dealing with it. The conversations were a project of New Futures, a nonprofit aimed at preventing and reducing substance abuse, in partnership with UNH's New Hampshire Listens. Together, they recently released a summary report from these gatherings, and while some findings are familiar, such as difficulty getting treatment, some might surprise you. Today in The Exchange, new conversations and new thinking about an old problem, substance abuse. Let's hear from you this hour. How would you answer the main question asked at all these events? What can we do together to address alcohol and other drug problems in our community? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Tim Rourke is here. He's Director of Substance Use Grantmaking at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and Chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Other Drugs. And Tim, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura. Happy to be here.
Also with us, Dave Cody, Marketing and Communications Associate for Serenity Place, a drug treatment center in Manchester. He himself is in long-term recovery. And Dave, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for making time out for us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Linda Saunders-Paquette, Executive Director at New Futures, as I said, a nonprofit aimed at preventing and reducing alcohol and drug abuse in the state. And Linda Saunders-Paquette, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good to see you, Laura. Thank you.
Well, Linda, I want to start with you since your report kind of got us going on this topic. Most people already know substance abuse is a problem. They know access to treatment is difficult. So what new did you hope to find out, Linda, by holding these sessions around the state in some pretty bad weather, I might add, in February and March of this year?
Well, we held these conversations really for three purposes. And one of those purposes was to really get a sense about what people who are living in communities that are experiencing substance abuse are thinking about. And one of the things that we were really struck by is that people really do understand that addiction is a chronic, relapsing brain disease and not a character flaw. And I think that basic understanding drove the four real findings and topics that were discussed during the conversation.
Did that surprise you?
It sort of did.
Is that a mind shift?
Yeah, I think it is a mind shift. And I think that people really are reading now and understanding, and there's science to support the fact that addiction is a disease.
I do wonder, Linda, in one sense, the people who came to these gatherings, again, braving the ice and snow, you know, were invested in the topic, interested in the topic. I wonder if you held sort of broad statewide conversations to other people who aren't as invested in this topic, if they would have the same attitude that this is a disease, a disorder, not a character flaw.
Well, I think we really had a good mix of people at these conversations. The vast majority of the people at the conversations were either family members of someone who has an addictive disorder or a friend of someone who has an addictive disorder. But we also had a number of just plain old community members, the general public, who were interested in learning more about the topic.
Yeah. What do you think, Tim? What jumps out for you from this series of, you know, nine conversations held around the state?
You know, I think, and to your earlier point, I think one of the things that does jump out is that there is, while there is this increased understanding that addiction is a disease, as Linda said, there is also a recognition that in some communities, community-level denial of the scope and the intensity of the problem has been a challenge in terms of really addressing it head-on, in terms of creating environments where people can seek recovery and treatment supports if they need it, and doing some of that good prevention work. A number of communities talked about that. And I think what was exciting about having these kinds of conversations is that the attempt was to get what I call sort of beyond the choir of those of us who are in the field, who live this every day, who see this work, we know it, and really start to engage other community stakeholders to come forward with their own stories and to hopefully walk away having learned something new. And I think in all of the community conversations that this report outlines, you started to see that. And I think that was an exciting piece, that it is the beginning of a way, I think, for us collectively to really make this a full community conversation and not limit it to those who might be either directly impacted or professionally affiliated with this issue in some way. And I think we are beginning to see more and more people coming out simply because they're concerned about this issue in their community, not because they have a direct tie to it, although that was part of it as well. And I think that's really exciting too.
So what kinds of people who might not have been in the choir before are starting to come into the choir or at least attend rehearsals?
Sure. And I think even in other conversations that have spurred from this and other work in communities, we're starting to see other healthcare providers. As we talk about this as a disease that's often been siloed into a specialty care setting, you see parents who are just concerned about the health of their communities that they're attempting to raise their children in. And seeing
even if their kids don't have problems right
exactly,
now.
Exactly. And from a prevention standpoint, that's what we need, is for parents to recognize that this is an issue and to become aware and educated and hopefully be part of the solution. And I think as well, hopefully new champions in schools and faith community and other community groups that are touched by this issue, whether they know it or not.
Yeah, you also see police coming out more and more on this issue as they're dealing with the crime effects of the heroin epidemic.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've been seeing that grow because of the opiate issue in our state for several years now, but they're taking a much more vocal role.
Well, and Dave, I'd love to hear from you too. And here's the question. As we look at these community meetings and what new has come out, what do you think most people don't get about substance abuse?
I really think that that the general public, there's a stigma about addiction and alcoholism that's really deeply ingrained in the community, and although a lot of people can say, yeah, I recognize it as a disease, a lot of them still treat it as a moral issue, and I think that's really what's holding a lot of people back. I'm here to share my story today, and because of what I want, which is to have other addicts, alcoholics, come out and express that they are in recovery. That's why I'm here. It was either do as I preach or stop preaching, and so that's why I showed up, and it really, I think the more people that come out, if you for lack of better words, the easier it's going to be for people to deal with addiction and alcoholism.
Tell us your story, if you could, Dave, briefly. I'd love to hear how you came to this place where you are now. You know, you've got a super job. You're clearly a well-functioning human being.
Early on in life, I had a great parents, and they raised me well. I was raised with a faith and in a loving home, and they were always there for us. But as I grew up, I started to make choices that led me down the wrong path, and I ended up an addict. And through a series of events, I ended up at the hospital at the time, CMC Hospital, had a detox. We're talking many years ago, but they had a detox, and I ended up in intensive care, then in the detox, and then after a few days, they talked to me about payment, and I had no money because I was unemployed, and so they told me that I needed to find a new place, and they set me up with Serenity Place. They actually got me a bed there. They put me in a cab and sent me over. And Serenity Place took me in. I had no money. I had nowhere to go. And they took me in, and they let me stay there until I could find treatment in a 28-day program. After the 28-day program, I tried to stay clean, and I bounced in and out of recovery for a few more months. And as of June 26th of this year, I celebrated 24 years of clean clean and sober living.
Wow. And so, it's important, I think, for you to say that you bounced up and down, you know, that's part of it, right? It isn't all just one straight, narrow path.
That's right. As far as the success rate goes, it's 1 in 32 that will get it the first time they try. And I was not 1 of 32.
I'm guessing it took me several tries. Yeah.
And that really is, you know, that's the pattern. And I think another thing, too, is that a lot of people see people go into treatment and they say, oh, they'll be all set now. And then they leave treatment and they relapse. And then they say, well, treatment doesn't work, you know, but it really does, you know, and I'm here to say that because the people around me didn't give up on me, I continued to try until I finally, you know, I finally caught it. And my, you know, sobriety is fragile. It's a day-to-day thing for anyone. It doesn't matter if you have one day or 24 years. It's day-to-day living. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that if I do the same thing today as I did yesterday, I'll get the same results. And that goes for good or bad.
I want to definitely ask everybody about treatment, how it works, how sometimes we feel like it doesn't work, but maybe we just need to think about it differently. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. And we've got folks on the phone already. We've got a tweet, Facebook comments. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And this hour, we're asking you the big question that was asked at all these community conversations around the state earlier this year. Here it is. What can we do together to address alcohol and other drug problems in our community? Let us know what you think. 1-800-892-6477. You know, Dave, I'm so struck by so many things you say, but as a parent myself, it's a little scary for me to hear you grew up in a good family, you had wonderful parents, they were always there for you, and still, you know, you made some wrong choices.
That really, you know, there's no other way of summing it up. It really is the way it happened. They're the choices that I made. And a lot of times it's not knowing that I had the disease of alcoholism or drug addiction that made me act the way I was acting. And then once I found out, then everything changed. And even though I relapsed, it was never the same.
Go ahead. And I'll let you finish that up in just a minute. I apologize there. And I know you two want to jump in as well. And we invite you into our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the growing problem of substance abuse in New Hampshire and a new series of community conversations focused on the question of how best to address the issue at the community level. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Dave Cody is here, Marketing and Communications Associate for Serenity Place, a drug treatment center in Manchester. Tim Rourke is also with us, Director of Substance Use Grant Making at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. And Linda Saunders-Paquette, Executive Director at New Futures, a nonprofit that works to prevent and reduce alcohol and drug abuse here in the Granite State. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. All of you, before we go to our listeners, Dave, I did want to give you a chance to finish up with that question I asked you. You said you grew up in a great family, you had great parents, you had a strong faith, and yet you still made choices that led you down the wrong path. I just wonder about that as we go into talking about prevention. Was there anything along the way that could have prevented that from happening? I know shoulda, coulda, woulda, but I just wonder about that.
I really, you know, I've thought back about this a lot, and really, a big part of it was not knowing that I had the disease, and it made me choose what I chose. Once I learned that I had the disease of alcoholism, I learned that I had a choice. And even though I relapsed or slipped a few times, I knew in the back of my head that it was my choice that I was relapsing, and eventually That's how I came to find recovery.
All right. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's a comment from our Facebook page from Philip, who says, I would like to know what your guests think about the concept of legalizing all drugs as a tool for fighting abuse. If users are not afraid of admitting their problems, it would be easier for them to seek treatment. Linda, I know this came up in the conversations. Lots of people talking about especially marijuana and the possibility that that might be legalized and how that would affect this problem of substance abuse. What did people say?
Well, it did come up in the conversation. And I think really the theme of the, of people's thinking around this is healthcare, not handcuffs. People now recognizing that addiction is a disease and understanding that many, many people are incarcerated as a result of their substance abuse think that incarceration is really not the best solution for this. And when we think about reform to our drug policies, we need to be thinking about what can we do to ensure that people who have an issue with substance abuse are able to access treatment. So I think we in New Hampshire, and certainly at New Futures, we do not support legalization of marijuana, for example. And there tends to be not a great understanding of what the difference is between marijuana legalization and marijuana decriminalization. Legalization involves sanctions by the state of New Hampshire that would allow for the growth, the sale, the regulation, the taxation of marijuana. That's what's happening in Colorado and Washington. And I think our view is let's take a wait-and-see approach around the experience in those states. And we're already seeing some very troubling results from legalization of marijuana in those states. Children having an increased access to marijuana, both smokable form and edible form, overdosing of children who end up in hospitals with very serious health issues. On the other hand, decriminalization means eliminating criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of marijuana. So rather than having the possession of a small amount of marijuana be a misdemeanor, a criminal offense, perhaps we ought to think about creating more of a violation approach to possession of small amounts of marijuana, along with making sure that there are protections for children and making sure that people can get treatment if they need it.
Well, Philip, thanks for the Facebook comment. And one other thing that jumped out in terms of New Hampshire's culture, New Hampshire's laws, Tim Rourke, I'll throw this to you. A lot of people in these conversations around the state said, hey, we're worried about alcohol abuse, but we have these giant and getting bigger all the time liquor stores right along the highway. What did folks say about sort of the mixed message there?
Well, it does provide a disconnect in some ways in the sense that our state profits handsomely off the sale of alcohol. New figures came out, record-setting profits this last fiscal year, around $640 million. Based on the sale of a drug that actually kills more people than all other drugs combined. So alcohol is a significant issue and a significant threat to public health, while it can be used responsibly by some. And I think that people do feel a disconnect. Now, on the one hand, it's important to recognize that being a control state, which means that the state regulates the sale of alcohol, is actually a prevention strategy. And when you look at particularly in states that do not have that level of regulation, they deal with issues around alcohol access to minors that we don't have here.
For example, in New Jersey, you can buy a bottle of gin at the Rite Aid.
Exactly.
I remember being struck by that.
You know, there have been over the last few years, there's been controversy around energy drinks that are infused with alcohol. And there was a anecdotal story. There was a state where the packaging of those drinks looks a lot like the packaging of regular energy drinks. And a grocery store accidentally stocked them in their regular soda aisle, which led to some significant, you know, kids in the emergency room and things of that nature.
Wow,
and
again, that's scary.
That's right. And so because we're a control state, certain products are not available for sale here in New Hampshire that might be more targeted for young people. You can't just walk down the street and purchase hard liquor necessarily. But the flip side of that is, what are we doing to mitigate the harm that the sale of that drug causes in our state? And, you know, we do have an alcohol fund, which is established to set aside 5% of gross profits from the sale of liquor in our state liquor stores to fund prevention, treatment, and recovery supports. We've had it for over 15 years, it's been fully funded only once.
Only once
only
in 15
once
years.
In the year that it was established. So in the current fiscal year, if the fund was fully funded, it would be worth about $8.5 million to support services in the community.
Treatment.
Treatment, prevention, recovery supports across the spectrum. Right now, it's at $1.75 million. The vast majority of that is funding some treatment work, and then there's about $250,000 a year in prevention. So I think there's a disconnect, and many people in the community and others have talked about that a lot. And I think we will see that conversation come up again as we enter into the budget process next year.
So let me just make sure I have this right. There's a fund, 5% of profits from state liquor sales are supposed to go toward prevention, treatment, and so forth.
Correct.
You're saying very little of that actually goes towards those purposes. Instead, it gets rated for the general fund.
Correct. So the legislature, in the budget process, the fund is actually zeroed out. And then in House Bill 2, which sets the rules that make the budget possible, they place some general fund money in it. So
let's go to our listeners. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. You can post a comment on our Facebook page like Philip did. Philip, thank you for that. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go first to Dave in Goffstown. Hi, Dave. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning, Laura. This is Dave Dorn. I'm the board chair for Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. We're a grassroots organization that's recently got started in Greater Manchester area. And one of the things that I would personally like to comment on, first off, I'm in long-term recovery from alcohol for a considerable amount of time. And here in the state of New Hampshire, the disconnect that I have seen take place ever since I've been in recovery is there is no conversation around the recovery side of addiction. And what is foreseen that we see coming down the road with a great deal of strength and support is a collaboration between prevention, treatment, intervention, and recovery. And that's the position that Hope for New Hampshire is taking now. Our mission is to increase the quality and the prevalence of long-term recovery from alcohol and drug addictions.
Well, it's great to hear from you, Dave. And Dave Cody, I'll turn to you. What do you think about what he says? There's no conversation around the recovery side of addiction.
Actually, I had this this discussion with the clinical director yesterday over at the lunch table that a lot of treatment facilities, what they do is they'll help an individual for the 7-day detox, the 28-day program, the 90 days in a halfway home or a transitional living program. And then from there, all of the follow-up is kind of resting on 12-step groups, where we're teaching people what to do, and then we're just sending them out there. And there's no long-term aftercare, and we're hoping that they latch on to NA or AA or even Smart Recovery or, groups like that.
NA is Narcotics Anonymous.
Narcotics
AA
Anonymous.
Is
Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead.
So
you're hoping that, I know you guys want to jump in, so hoping that they'll latch onto one of those groups, but if they don't, they're just kind of left hanging.
Right.
I do wonder, too, NA and AA are familiar to a lot of people. I'm wondering, Dave, though, if those models don't work for everybody, then what do you do if you're just not comfortable in that atmosphere?
Well, I think it's up to the individual. Each individual really has to pick what works for them and stick with it. It really, at that point, it's down to choice again. So, for instance, somebody who is a long-term drug addict might choose AA because they prefer the people in the halls of AA. Other people won't go anywhere near AA if they're a drug addict because it doesn't have anything to do with their drug of choice. I was always taught a drug is a drug is a drug. It doesn't matter how you use it, or where you get your help. Get your help where you can.
I know you guys want to jump in too. Linda, go ahead.
Well, Laura, one of the themes of the conversations that we held focused on recovery. And people talked about how important it is for folks who are in long-term recovery from addiction to tell their story and talk about recovery so people understand that recovery is possible and people lead successful, happy lives afterwards. The other piece of recovery that folks talked about during the conversations was the need for a comprehensive recovery support system in New Hampshire, which we are lagging behind other New England states in developing. And Hope for New Hampshire Recovery in particular is working hard to build that recovery support services system here in New Hampshire.
How do you even do that, though, Linda? I mean, that just sounds giant.
Well, many other states have recovery centers around in various communities around their states. And that's a place where people who are in recovery and who need support to sustain their recovery can go. They get a variety of services. There might be employment supports, housing supports, and recovery coaching available to them. So 12-step programs aren't the only option for folks. They're one very important option. And I just want to say, you know, I'm a survivor of cancer. And after I had my cancer treatment, I had a whole variety of supports available to me. And that just doesn't happen for folks who are in recovery from addiction.
So you're kind of answering this question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, Linda. So the difference then between having a good system of treatment and recovery, it's two different things. It sounds like the treatment centers are the places where you go when you need treatment from your addiction to help you get over it. I mean, maybe not cure it, but get over it. Recovery is different. It's sort of you're 5 years out, 10 years out, 20 years out, like Dave, and you still need some support once in a while. That's
correct.
The difference.
Correct. So using the cancer analogy, you know, there's surgery and radiation and other treatment available for people who have cancer.
That's the treatment.
That's the treatment. And afterwards, support for healthy living, support, sort of psychological support for dealing with your issue, that is readily available. The same holds true for people with other chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease, but not so much for people who are recovering from addiction.
That's very interesting. Tim, go ahead.
Sure. You know, there's a film that's been screened around the state several times. There'll be other screenings upcoming called The Anonymous People, which is about the history of the recovery movement in the United States. And the director and the folks in that film make a note that people don't recover in treatment. You find recovery in treatment, but people actually recover in community. And I think when we look at the issues of stigma that have prevented for a long, long time, I think the kind of conversation we're trying to have right now, you know, people find recovery because the community welcomes them at some point. And I think the cancer analogy is the perfect one in terms of the yellow wristbands and the immediate response when you hear someone who's been impacted by that issue, it typically is very there's a very different response even now when someone does come out and share a story of recovery from substance use. And I think that's a piece of this that needs to change. And hopefully over time, building those multiple pathways in the community that are community supported, that's what sustains recovery. And it's a chronic illness, as Dave shared in his own story, that, you know, people find recovery and then they may lose it again and they need a way to get back. And it requires long-term support. That's provided in the community. Anyone who's got a chronic illness at some point wants to connect with their community and not just stay in that quote-unquote clinical setting.
Okay. So I want to go to another call, but I have to ask you now, Dave, since you raised this, Tim. All right. So yellow wristbands for cancer, pink obviously for breast cancer. I mean, would people in recovery like yourself, Dave, wear a wristband saying, hey, look at me, I'm part of this recovery movement?
It's up to the individual. At work, I deal with a lot of people that are new in recovery, and they're very energetic about, you know, how they're, you know, you see leaps and bounds early on. It's not just little minuscule changes that happen. It's you get your health back very, you know, once you put the drugs or the alcohol down, your health starts to come back and you start to think clearly. And so they're very excited about their recovery. So a lot of times, you know, putting on a T-shirt with the treatment facility or wearing a wristband or something like that is very they're very excited to do it
because it's affirming.
They want to show everybody that they're better and that they're getting better or, you know, that they're moving in the right direction. And I think that, you know, the further out that they get from that or people get from that, it tends to tone down a little bit. I have a T-shirt for work. And we had a function the other day, and it was a barbecue at a local vendor, and at and we all wore our T-shirts, but there were 40 of us. So, you know, 40 people is kind of this power in numbers, you know, between the volunteers and the staff that showed up, you know, this power in numbers. But to wear that T-shirt that says Recovery Happens on it and to just go, you know, shopping at the mall or walking down Main Street, it's a little different. So...
Do you wear that T-shirt when you go shopping at the mall?
I do not.
Yeah.
I do not wear T-shirts. So.
He's very well-dressed at this moment, too. I want to let people know. Let's go back to our listeners, and Lou joins us from Manchester. Hi, Lou. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I listen to your program all the time.
Great.
And, I really enjoy it. This is hard to put into a 90-second snippet, but I'm going to do it as best I can, and then I'm going to hang up. I adhere to a 12-step program that has saved my life. And they've written a book that came out in April of 1939 called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the derivatives of that with gambling, sex, food, et cetera, has gone on with a 12-step program. That book clearly says that this is exactly what this book is about, to enable you to find a higher power. I'm aligned with that. I'm aligned with the disease concept. And I've had the good fortune of being straight for many years, which I don't really like to talk about publicly. But after about 5 years of being straight, I sought some professional help. And the most profound thing that's ever been told to me in my life was told by this psychiatrist. He said, Lewis, sometimes your will cannot defeat your genetic predisposition. Now, there's no certainty if it's environment or if it's genes, but the bottom line is the addict has to have a willingness to want to be straight. This isn't about all the enablers that can be around to save their life. What that program is saying is that you need to rely on a higher power and not on people.
Lou, thank you.
Yeah. And I'm grateful for that.
Thank you.
I'm grateful for that.
Thank you for calling in. And his point raises something I wanted to ask you about, Linda, that came out from these conversations that jumped out at me, another one of those, gee, I didn't know that moments. So we'll talk about that in just a moment and take a lot more of your calls and emails. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, what's wrong and what's right with New Hampshire State Parks. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, substance abuse in New Hampshire. A new initiative hopes to tackle this old problem in a more informed way. Let's hear from you this hour. 1-800-892-6477. As we look at the results of community conversations held around the state this winter, we're asking you the big question that everyone at these events was asked. What can we do together to address alcohol and other drug problems in our community? Join us with your thoughts on that, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. And Linda, stemming from our caller's point, Lou, talking about the importance of Alcoholics Anonymous and so forth and how hard it is for some people to get into treatment. One of the things that jumped out from these community conversations for me that I hadn't thought about before is there are certain groups of people who are really, really fearful of asking for treatment. Who were those groups specifically?
Well, specifically, members of the military are very concerned about admitting that they've got an issue. They're concerned about losing their position. Also, doctors and lawyers are very concerned about, I think, publicly admitting that they have an issue. That said, the New Hampshire Bar Association has a program called the Lawyers Assistance Program, and it is there. And I think that the Medical Society has a comparable program, and they are there to help lawyers and doctors who have issues with addiction get the help that they need.
I can see the hesitation, though. I mean, New Hampshire is a very small community. Everybody talks, and especially if you have a professional license, you wouldn't want to do anything that might make you lose that professional license. You work hard for that license.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we have talked about people in recovery telling their stories, but AA is based on the principles of anonymity. And in part, you know, those principles of anonymity have been very, very important to people who were attempting to recover from addiction. And they are rooted in the stigma that's associated with having an addictive disorder. Your last caller, I think, makes an interesting point. For some people, AA and the tenets of AA are extremely important. As we like to say, there are many paths to recovery. And as Dave has said, it's really an individual approach to what's best going to work for you as you are sustaining your recovery.
This is really interesting, Linda. Let me ask you one more question on this, and then we'll go back to our listeners. Are you saying that, you know, AA is great for some folks, the anonymity, it's really important, but that in another sense, it might, well, hamper people from sharing their stories publicly and contribute to this cloud of shame and stigma?
Absolutely. And Tim mentioned the film, The Anonymous People. And frankly, that's what that film is all about. You know, the question is raised, has anonymity been a barrier to us in implementing policies that support prevention and treatment and recovery services? And there's analogy to people who have suffered from AIDS, for example, and that whole movement where people came out and talked about their disease and the impact that had on changing policies so people could get the treatment that they needed.
Let's go back to our listeners. And David's calling us from the Seacoast. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Laura. This is Senator David Waters. How are you today?
Welcome, Senator. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, and thanks to Dave for his really compelling story, and it's much appreciated. And I just wanted to, mention what we have tried to do about the Alcohol Fund and, a lot of leadership from Senator Forrester, and I proposed in the health protection plan we passed that we try to get waivers so that the funding we're spending on drug and alcohol treatment can be matched by the federal government, and that would mean we wouldn't have to kind of rob that money from that fund and stick it in the general fund. So I think we're going to have some good news on that. It's, that whole process is underway, getting those waivers, but what I've learned in my years in the Senate and the House is that we just have to do more. We've got to get more treatment and recovery, and I'm also concerned about getting more treatment programs in our county jails.
So under Medicaid expansion, there's a possibility, you're saying, Senator Waters, of that 5% that's supposed to be there from liquor profits of actually being there. That's what you're aiming toward.
And what I proposed was that we, you can get a waiver if you are demonstrating that you're spending money on a program and that the federal government agrees that they can provide matching funds for that. So I asked that there be an inclusion in what we sent down to Washington for the waivers, somewhere around $8 to $10 million that we could demonstrate we're spending. And if the waivers get approved, then we would have that money to match, and it would mean that, we could actually spend it on what it's supposed to be spent and then not have the alcohol fund go into the general fund.
Okay. Senator Waters, I appreciate you chiming in on this.
Thanks so much. Great show.
Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, and I wanted to thank Senator Waters and Senator Forrester, as he alluded, and Senate President Morris as well, has talked a lot in his public comments about the alcohol fund and recognizing this as an issue. And it's important for folks to understand what the health protection program actually does in addition to the potential financial resources, because beginning in August, for the first time, those who are newly eligible for Medicaid because of the health protection program will have a substance use disorder benefit where they will actually be able to see a treatment provider and have the insurance cover that. And because we have not had a substance abuse benefit in our Medicaid system. So for many, many people for whom finances are an issue, as Dave talked about with his own experience early in his recovery, this is a profound opportunity for the state of New Hampshire and probably one of the most exciting things that we've seen in a generation in terms of being able to increase the ability to provide people who need treatment because we'll have insurance that will cover it.
Yeah. And Dave, a quick question to you about that as well. You talked about your own story, how some 20, 25 years ago, even though you didn't have money, you were able to get great treatment. And here you are today. What do you hear from people that you work with now at Serenity Place in Manchester about how they pay for treatment and recovery?
Well, Serenity Place is one of the only places that will allow people to come in regardless of their ability to pay. Most treatment facilities, you need to pay up front or you need to have insurance but with Serenity Place, first of all, our fees are much lower than most other places. But if you can't afford to pay, you can still receive the treatment that you need. Obviously, if you can afford to pay some, then some should be paid. But it really, that's one thing that we kind of pride ourselves on, is that we'll help anyone as long as they want it. And it really that seems to be the people that are gravitating towards us. I don't remember the exact statistic, but a majority of the people in our detox unit are homeless.
So they clearly can't pay.
Right.
Yeah. Did you want to quickly jump in on that, Linda?
Well, I did. And one of the populations that's going to benefit the most from the New Hampshire Health Protection Plan is the corrections population. We know that about 90% of people on parole and probation who have their parole and probation or probation revoked is as a result of a substance use problem. So this is a population that as they come out of a correctional facility, many of these people will now be eligible for health insurance coverage under the health protection plan and will be able to access services.
And will there be enough providers for them?
Well, that is something that the state of New Hampshire is working very hard on. There's been a wonderful collaboration between the governor's office, the Department of Health and Human Services, providers, the managed care organizations, New Futures, the governor's commission, to make sure that people will have access to the treatment that they need.
So does that mean like going to the colleges and, you know, encouraging people to consider careers in substance abuse and recovery and so forth? Because right now what we hear of for young people is STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering and math. We don't hear, would you like to become a substance abuse counselor?
I think there will be a particular focus, and the waiver that Senator Waters spoke to speaks to this a lot around workforce development, both within higher education and within the existing workforce. In the broader healthcare industry, as we begin to treat substance use in the broader healthcare industry, how do we make sure that doctors, nurse practitioners, other specialties who may touch someone who has a substance use issue be properly trained to do that? So that will be certainly a focus of some of what will come with the waiver that will come into the state for workforce development. And it will be a slow build over time. We are a state where we have some of the lowest treatment access capacity in the country. The only other state you're less likely to get treatment in is Texas. So we have a long way to go before we can arrive at a place where we have, you know, real full treatment capacity in the state where someone can get immediately the right level of care that they need when they're ready to get it. But there's a lot of work at a lot of tables right now to build that, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, that's a big workforce issue then, getting folks interested, getting them to invest in that career. Also, Tim, I'm guessing it's not that lucrative given Medicaid reimbursement rates and so forth. I mean, people will have coverage, but it's not, you know, gold-plated coverage.
I think so. It will be a challenge. And I also think remembering that as well, because this is an issue that impacts everybody, that the insurance coverage in Medicaid, which we refer to as parity, the ability to provide financing for substance use, also applies in the private market. So I think we are there's an industry build opportunity here. And I think a lot of – there are incentives in the waiver to incentivize providers with higher reimbursement rates if they choose to expand their substance abuse capacity, retain the capacity they have. So I think there are ways in which we are trying to address some of the challenges, which are true with lots of social service healthcare delivery systems where reimbursements and things are somewhat of a challenge when we talk about compensation and really keeping a vibrant workforce.
All right. And let's go to Tracy in Laconia. Hi, Tracy. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. This is Tracy Fowler calling from the Lakes Region Partnership for Public Health. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm one of the 13 regional prevention coordinators that exist in our state. We help to communities to plan and implement evidence-based prevention strategies. So we're out there as a resource. And I guess in listening to the conversation and reading through this report that is so important, and I'm so glad that New Futures published this, I think it really I guess my comment is really around the importance of approaching substance abuse as with this continuum of care model in mind. And I think, you know, we can't really silo out prevention, treatment, and recovery because we're all such an important part of this issue.
Well, Tracy, if I could ask you a question, I'm so glad you called because we haven't talked that much about prevention this hour, and I would love to talk to you about that. Tim mentioned earlier that a lot of people whose lives have not personally been touched by substance abuse are starting to get involved in this conversation
right.
because they're concerned about the quality of life in their communities, they're concerned about their kids, they're concerned
right.
about crime and so forth. So what do we know these days about what works and what doesn't? I mean, you know, when I was a kid, it was scared straight. You know,
yeah,
don't
yeah.
do this or you'll
right.
end up in jail. I mean, does that
right.
work?
Well, well, it's funny you say that because, you know, I remember the This Is Your Brain on Drugs commercial with the egg and the frying pan,
right.
you know, and that was sort of that was it. I mean, that's the only thing I remember seeing when I was in school. But
just made you want to eat eggs.
It made you hungry. No, but I think prevention has evolved quite a bit. And what was mentioned a lot, or I noticed a couple of times in the report, was, you know, community members wondering what are the prevention strategies, and they mentioned DARE as something, you know, as an education piece. And we've come a long way from DARE, and there's quite a bit of evidence behind what we do now. So we really use data and to drive our strategies now, and we've got each region actually has a plan in place, a strategic plan, with strategies to implement, prevention strategies that are evidence-based, that, you know, that need support and funding to implement them. But we've come a long way, and I think that for folks who are looking to get involved, there are ways to join efforts and to join prevention efforts at the community level, because it certainly takes a village. I know that's a cliche and it's been overused, but it's true.
Well, Tracy, can you give me just a quick sense, though, of what strategies work and what doesn't? Again, we sort of joked about the eggs frying in the pan, but, you know, so what messages, efforts, and so forth do work, or what doesn't?
So I think what, you know, as far as best practices go, thinking prevention-wise, it's got to be a range. So there are things like education and providing information, and that's great and that's important, and it's got to be consistent. So, for example, messages that we do for students, it can't just be a one-time, we do this during prom season to talk about how bad drinking and driving is. It has to be integrated throughout a curriculum. So it's got to be consistent messaging around building resiliency and making healthy choices. And that can happen. That can start in elementary school. Oftentimes we start that kind of a thing in high school, and that's a little bit too late. So I think we have to reframe how we are approaching this. You know, so the education is a start, but then it evolves. There are things all the way down to changing policies at the local level. You know, those are prevention strategies that can really be effective. So it's got to be almost a mix of, you know, providing education, giving information, changing even the physical design of communities is a strategy. Keeping the lights on in a park, for example, that gets a lot of drug activity. Well, let's try and figure out how we can combine efforts to get the lights back on and keep them on. You know, strategies like that. It's a much more broad-based approach to thinking about prevention.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for calling in, because we did need to talk about prevention. That's so, so important. Dave, I just wonder what you think works in terms of, you know, scared straight messages, don't touch this stuff. You know, what actually works in terms of prevention and what doesn't? I mean, I know nobody has the answer, but I just wonder what you think.
I really don't have a clear answer on that, because, you know, I grew up in the era of just say no, you know, with Nancy Reagan. And obviously it's so much more than that, you know, especially as somebody who's gone through it. You know, just saying no is not – it's not the all – you know, the end all, the be all end all. It's really – it's more than that, because once you say no, then it's changing your lifestyle. It's changing the people you hang around with. It's changing what you do for pastimes, you know, all of that. So –
so something a little more comprehensive than that.
It really,
that.
You know, it's more than just a slogan. It can't just be a slogan, because obviously they don't work.
Linda, I can see you're dying to jump in there.
Well, I am. And, you know, there's a great deal of research on which kinds of policies work to reduce problems with alcohol and other drugs. I'll give you an example. Last year, there was a piece of legislation in the legislature that would have allowed alcohol advertising on billboards.
I remember that.
Yes. And so research shows that limiting exposure of kids to advertising for alcohol, for example, is a strategy that helps prevent problems with alcohol.
Tim?
And I think there's not just one. It requires a multitude of strategies at once. And one thing that's important to leave folks with is that when it comes to youth, our substance use rates are dropping. And they're dropping because of the work of Tracy and her colleagues and folks like Linda who are – and everybody who's come to recognize that there isn't a silver bullet on this. It requires a comprehensive solution with all partners, law enforcement, healthcare, educators, people in recovery, at tables talking together, which is what these conversations were about. So this is a really difficult challenge for us to overcome. But there are pieces of this where we're seeing real progress, and that is particularly true in prevention, and hopefully with some new financing, we'll get there even faster.
All right. It's great to talk to all of you. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Dave, it was great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Dave Cody, Marketing and Communications Associate at Serenity Place. Linda, good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Linda Saunders-Paquette, Executive Director at New Futures, and Tim Rourke. Thank you also for your time.
Thank you.
Tim Rourke, he's Director of Substance Use Grant Making at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. This is The Exchange on NHPR.